Before I get into new material, are there questions from the first day's material? Which, by the way, I have posted the audio file to the website, but somehow in all the chaos on Tuesday, I misplaced the class notes. I was going to go check the other classroom to see if I might have left them there. If I can't find them, then while you're doing the lab today, I'll rewrite the notes and then post them. Please, that water bottle were in lab. No water bottles in lab. But questions about the first day material. How many of you read the sections that were listed on the syllabus for Tuesday and for today? Oh dear. Now for the rest of you, why not? Because, you know, I got up on my soapbox Tuesday and said that I know how pastochem classes have functioned, and this is how pastochem classes have functioned, but that's not necessarily the way we want to do things. Yes?
I saw a video.
You did?
Yes.
If you got a really cool link, could you send it to me? No, because this is hard stuff to visualize, and I am going to do a little demonstration over here. And I'll segueing into this material, I'll say that we're going to do just an overview of those things we really need to know for OCHEM. So, standing waves, I'm going to do a demonstration that some of you might have seen before with a telephone cord, because that will let me model a simple system of standing waves. The reason we're doing that is because electrons act as standing waves, and so we're going to make that connection between standing waves and then quantization of energy. The fact that electrons will only have very specific energy values. That's going to lead us into the shapes of atomic orbitals, which 99% of the time we're going to be talking about just s and p orbitals. So we need to understand where those shapes come from. We're not going to use them today, but we're just going to review what are the electron filling rules, because we'll use that all three quarters, and especially once we get into spectroscopy. Related to that, we need to know what an electron configuration is. Not that we're going to be writing them all the time, but there's a connection between electron configuration, valence electrons, and the behavior of atoms. So this is going to be a reminder, for example, of why would an atom like oxygen want to normally be negatively 2 charged. So I guess I should put in here the octet rule. And then we'll just have a brief note about isotopes. Carbon and hydrogen, we do exploit both of them in their isotopes in spectroscopy and in kinetics. So let me go ahead and do this phone cord demonstration, which, let me turn the lights back on for just a moment. If you can't quite see from where you're sitting, do feel free to move over here. And I guess the people coming in late will just have to wait a little bit. So if you watch the way that I move this, if I move at just some steady but slow pace, there isn't anything that interesting that happens with this cord. It kind of wobbles around in a random way until I get up to some minimum speed, and then you can see that with very little effort, I'm able to keep the cord going at a very consistent pace. Slow down again, and it very rapidly just decays back into random motion. Speed up again, there's that nice steady pace, and then if I speed up just a little bit more, you see that it also starts getting into random motion. Until I slow down again, and all of a sudden, that first wave pops right back into action. Now, so that means that at some specific energy that I'm putting into it, this system is able to persist a little bit on the low side. It disappears a little bit on the high side. It disappears. But if I keep increasing in energy, you folks will just have to wait a moment. Sorry. So just as I increase in energy, then you'll see that a new wave pops into existence. And you can see that if I do this right, there's one place in the middle here where the wave appears not to be moving. Those of you who've seen this demonstration before or remember your quantum, what is that position where no movement is occurring called? It's a node, that's right. And then again, as I slow back down, this wave will disappear. It'll be totally random until I slow down enough where I get back to that specific, if we want to use that term, energy level. So there's one energy level here. Then if I speed up a little bit, there's a second energy level. I think I'm going to pull the phone off the wall if I try to get up to the next one. Oh, there we go. So you see, you hit just the right energy amount, and for a moment there, I had a wave that had two nodes in the middle. So the lowest wave, which we can call N equals 1, like we might have done for atomic energy levels, that had 0 notes in it.
Could you do the one with the 2 notes again?
I'll try. I'm having difficulty, but there we go.
All we have to do, oh my gosh, now there's 2.
Yeah. So the first wave had 0 nodes, the second wave had 1 node, the third wave had 2 nodes. Let me write this down on paper, a diagram, so we can talk a little bit more about it. Come on in. I'm sorry, could you say that again? That's right. The more energy that we put in, the more nodes that are generated, and it's specific amounts of energy that correspond to these specific waves that have whole numbers of nodes. And that's the whole point of a standing wave, that there are only very specific standing waves that can exist based on the boundary conditions established by whatever physical system that we've got. So this is a case where we had principally 2 fixed endpoints. Now, this is not a perfect system, so I did have to wiggle it, but we can imagine that we had 2 fixed endpoints, like on a string of a musical instrument, for example. And then there was the principal wave that could exist that stretched all the way from one endpoint to the other. And then mathematically, if you think of that as a sine function, you call it sine theta. Well, the only next wave that would match both of those endpoints would be sine 2 theta, and then sine 3 theta. So we get something that looks like this. So here's that first principal wave stretching all the way across. And again, that's N equals 1, and we have 0 nodes. The next highest wave, chopped exactly halfway through, and that's N equals 2, where we had 1 node. And then the last one that I successfully generated, whereas where it crossed the axis twice. So that was N equals 3. And that's 2 nodes. And so in general, we can define a standing wave as some kind of non-propagating wave. A propagating wave would be something like light or sound that moves through a medium. But this is fixed in a sense. Although for those of you who do like math, if you take 2 propagating waves that are synced exactly right and have them moving in opposite directions, that ends up mathematically being the same as a standing wave. But a standing wave is a non-propagating wave with 1 or more, I'll call them boundary conditions. I could say endpoints, but when we get to electrons, that would be kind of an incorrect term to use. Now, in doing that demonstration, I mentioned this term node. So let's define that. A node is a place on a wave that has a value of 0. And we'll talk about what the consequences are of these nodes in just a moment. Now, there's this term quantization that I had listed as one of the topics we need to get through. Quantization refers to the fact that energy only occurs in these very specific packets. Now, back in Chem 1, you might have talked about 2 experiments that demonstrates the quantization of energy in electronic systems. The first one you might have discussed is the photoelectric effect. The fact that if you have a metal sheet that is responsive to light, there's some minimum frequency that you must cross over before that metal will respond. So, for example, you could shine red light, which, by the way, is red light shorter or longer in wavelength than blue light? It is longer. So red's long wavelength, blue's short wavelength. Does that mean the frequency of red light is higher or lower than blue light? It's lower. Longer wavelength means lower frequency. As we'll talk about once we hit spectroscopy, lower frequency means lower energy per photon, which a photon, that's a piece of light, which is a wave, which is a particle, which is a wave and a particle and both and neither, which is quantum summed up in a nutshell. But anyways, in that photoelectric effect, what happens is these photons, each one have to have a minimum packet of energy in order to excite electrons, in order for a metal to respond. We saw something similar to that with atomic spectra. If you were here from Chem 1A and you saw that hydrogen tube and had to see through a prism to find the different color bands that show up, the whole point of that experiment is to show there's technically an infinite number, but what's known as a countably infinite number of these different wavelengths that come out. And these very specific wavelengths are caused by specific transitions between different energy levels. So you don't just have any old random energy level for an electron. They're very specific or quantized values. And that's the connection to showing you standing waves, because standing waves, that's another type of system in which energy can only have very specific values. So let me put down quantization of energy. It is that in a standing wave, there are only certain waves that can exist based on the boundary conditions. Again, think of what we saw, that there was this long wave that I could generate, but a little low in energy, a little high in energy, nothing useful happened. Again, if I went up enough in energy, then I got that second wave that had a node in it. But again, a little bit of below or a little bit above, and that wave could not exist. So because you have only these certain waves, these waves will only have very particular energy levels associated with them. Which in short means energy is quantized. Now this system, you could say, is a one-dimensional system that's then being made to wave. This is actually the way of doing a simple quantum concept experiment called the particle in a box. So if you trap an electron in a one-dimensional line like this, we can cut to the end of the story and say, yes, we know that electrons have wave behavior. And in this particle in a box system, the waves generated by an electron will look exactly like these same waves that we saw in this phone cord system. So it being a relatively simple mathematical system to model, if you take physical chemistry or advanced physics, that's a problem that's very commonly done. But how does this then lead to atomic orbitals? Well, we'll take it one step at a time. Imagine that we take this linear system and turn it into two dimensions. We wrap it around into a ring. Depending on what textbook you used for Chem 1A, you might have seen diagrams like this before, where they draw a ring, and then they show a wave going around that ring. So imagine that it starts somewhere on the curve, crosses, 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 and eventually comes back and exactly overlaps with itself again. This is similar to what happens in the following example. Imagine if any of you have ever seen a wine glass or some other thin kind of glass container, where you take your finger and run around the edges of it. Anybody had ever seen that done? No? Maybe I'll bring an empty wine glass one day to class to show you then. Because that glass will only generate one specific musical note that depends on how big is the glass, what kind of glass you have, how much water that's in it. But in other words, all that physical aspect of that glass, that sets up the boundary conditions that allow only the specific note to be able to exist. And that note exists because as it's wiggling around, it exactly reinforces itself. And so that's the same type of thing that I'm trying to demonstrate here. Because this wave overlaps with itself, it will just keep on persisting. But if you had instead a wave that didn't overlap itself properly, as it's going around and around and around, when it comes back, it doesn't overlap, which means it's going to end up interfering with itself. Now, I got to qualify that term a little bit, because interference is not necessarily a bad thing. When we talk about bonding, we're going to talk about constructive interference, which is where waves reinforce themselves, or destructive interference, which is waves will cancel each other out. Well, this second example that I've shown you, where the wave does not match itself, that would end up generating deconstructive interference. And so that wave would dissipate. Although I'm showing you circular systems, this idea of standing waves shows up all over the place. For those of you who've got really fancy car audio systems, you know you've got that one sample CD that you have that one note that when you hit it, the entire neighborhood around you will rattle because your car hits the right resonant frequency. Same kind of idea. So if we started with the linear system, that generates only specific waves with specific shapes, we could end up writing these slightly fancier two-dimensional systems. Now, they'll have to do this on the next piece of paper, but let me write just a little summary of what I was trying to show with these two diagrams. That in this first situation, because the wave exactly overlaps itself, it is compatible with the boundary conditions of the system and will reinforce itself. For the other one, because the wave does not overlap itself, then it will deconstructively interfere with itself and disappear. So, again, first, the foam cord experiment to show only specific waves exist. Second, we pull it around in a loop and show there's other more complicated systems where the same situation occurs. Only specific waves can exist. Yeah. Well, if to have perfect deconstructive interference, yes. But even if it's not completely opposite, it's still going to attenuate that wave. Then as it goes around again, it may further attenuate itself. And so on average, eventually the wave will just dissipate. If you have two different waves to exactly cancel themselves out, then yes, they have to have exactly the same amplitude, same frequency, but opposite phase, where one's going up, the other one's going down at exactly the same time. other questions before I now move on to atomic orbitals. Because take this two-dimensional system, pull it into the sphere, and the same story occurs, where there are only very specific waves that can exist. In this case, for an atom, the boundary condition is the fact that you've got a nucleus right in the center of the atom. Since the nucleus is positively charged and the electron is negatively charged, then that interaction is what sets up all the shapes of the different atomic orbitals. So, let me make this statement. Electrons are described by these things called wave functions, which are just equations of a wave, but we give it this special name. So electrons are described by wave functions, which are mathematical representations of the wave behavior of an electron. We don't really have the time for me to give too many examples proving electrons behave like waves, but slowly once we ease into spectroscopy, I might try to bring that topic back. So electrons are described by wave functions, which the common symbol for a wave function is the capital Greek letter psi. And these wave functions are mathematical representations. Oh, sorry. I gotta get this other vision screen fixed over here. Representations of the wave behavior of an electron. These waves, again, have the nucleus as the boundary condition for these waves. So they are standing waves. That means that the unique shapes of the atomic orbitals are all caused by the presence of exactly and only one nucleus. So all the atomic orbitals, if you look at them, they all have symmetry that revolves around that nucleus. And to tie this back to what we were talking about previously, because these are standing waves, only a certain number of these waves can exist. So there are, again, technically an infinite number, but there, to jump a little bit ahead, we know there's such thing as a 1s orbital, a 2s orbital, which an orbital is just the space described by a wave function. But there's no such thing as a 1.5s orbital. And that's, again, because energy occurs only in fixed quantities. So because wave functions act like standing waves, only certain wave functions can exist.
Ooh, better get a different green. Okay.
So what of this might I ask you about on a quiz or exam? You might be wondering that to yourself at the moment. Well, the main point, again, is that standing waves, there are only certain ones of them. And it's caused by whatever physical system that wave is wiggling around in. Those specific waves have very specific energies. That's the whole point of all of this so far. Yes? That's right. They could, but they would have to have similar physical systems. And in fact, if you had two perfectly identical glasses that had exactly the same physical conditions, if you started a wave off in one glass, in real life, the sound wave will induce a resonance in the other glass. So for example, if you have a piano around, and you may have some other instrument that's playing near it, you'll hear little echoes of that instrument in the piano as the correct strings are caused to resonate by something else that's nearby. You can have the same wave, but you have to have the same or similar physical systems.
It cannot be happening. I mean, you can't apply it. It's an electron
bulb. I can't quite hear you. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
No. It's because we have this background hiss that's constant. So that's why I have to talk with this kind of voice so that you all back there can hear me. Oh, no, it can happen with an electron. No. And in fact, to move electrons between energy levels, all electrons are equal in a sense. It's just to move between the different energy levels, you have to have the right packets of energy. And we'll get into that as we get a little bit later in the quarter. Now, what do these atomic orbitals look like? Which, again, let me give you a definition of an orbital. An orbital is a region in space described by a wave function. But these wave functions have nasty equations associated with them. And unless we are particle physicists, there's no need for us to know those equations. Instead, we can represent those equations using a set of what are called quantum numbers. And it's from those quantum numbers that we get the names of the different orbitals, like 1s, 2s, 2p. So let me just for a moment explain a bit about these quantum numbers. We only really need two of them in this class. But I want to get to those two, because understanding where these shapes come from will help us when we get to molecular orbitals. So a wave function is generally written in what's called spherical coordinates. So normal Cartesian space has three dimensions, x, y, z, but we can represent that space also with coordinates r, theta, phi. This equation would more appropriately be written by something called a Hamiltonian, something called a Hamiltonian operator. More simply put it, I'll tell you this. Playing around with the equation a bit, you can actually split this up into two different functions. One of these functions depends only on r, how far away you are from the atom. And so imagine this. For those of you who've had some form of physics, you know that electric field depends on, or not electric field, electric force depends on two charges, the size of those charges, and then just how far away they are apart from each other. So start with the atom that's got a positively charged nucleus. You've got an electron that's negatively charged. And so that distance sets up a certain energy level. So one of these functions is dependent just on that distance. The other function is related to where around a sphere is that electron. And so one of these we call the radial function, again, deals with just how far away from the electron, or from the nucleus, an electron is. and the other is called the spherical. And there's a connection between the radial and spherical. And to get into that, let's now define these quantum numbers. The quantum numbers represent the different possible wave functions in an atom. Three of the quantum numbers describe an orbital. The fourth one, spin, just says whether the electron is spinning up or down. So quantum numbers, those are used to represent the possible wave functions in an atom. And three of the numbers are used to describe a specific orbital. So what are these two quantum numbers that you need to know? Well, one of them is called the principal quantum number, which, does anybody remember what symbol we use to represent that principal quantum number? I've actually already used it today. It's n. N equals 1, n equals 2, n equals 3. That's the principal quantum number, which represents the total number of packets of energy in an electron. So if you think again of this demonstration I did, below a certain energy level, nothing useful was happening. Once you reached a certain magic energy level, then something could exist. Well, for an electron to exist around the nucleus, it can't fall below a certain energy level because there's nothing below it that exists, which is why an electron can't fall into the nucleus. So n equals 1 is the lowest energy level. Then put additional packets of energy in it, and that's how we get n equals 2, n equals 3, so on and so forth. This n value is the number in the orbital name. So if you say 2s, that's an n equals 2 orbital. So n is the principal quantum number. And represents the total number of packets of energy in an electron. And n has to be greater than or equal to 1. If you don't have that packet of energy, you don't have an electron. What's the other one? Well, here's why I explain this difference between the radial and the spherical functions. Because what that means is, let's say you start out with an electron that's just got one packet of energy. When you put that second packet of energy in, there's actually a choice of where that energy can go. That energy could be used to get the electron further from the nucleus. So then that energy shows up in the radial function. Or that energy might be used to send effectively the electron spinning more rapidly around the nucleus. So this is going to be a little bit tricky because I know not everybody's had physics. But if you have not an electron, but an object with a certain mass that's zooming along all by itself through space, you know, the classic, an object in motion stays in motion, what quantity, what physical property do we say that that object has as it's just moving right along? Inertia. And inertia is related to what? Well, force, but let's say if we didn't have a force acting on it, it's just going to move all on its own until a force changes that. But what is it that it changes? Momentum. If we take an object that has momentum, but it has momentum because it's turning around, what do we call that? It's called angular momentum. Well, this second quantum number is called orbital angular momentum, which might have been just a term you memorized, but what that means is how much is that orbital rotating around the nucleus? That's one way of visualizing what's going on. So orbital angular momentum can be interpreted as how much energy is directed around the nucleus. Because one packet of energy is used always just to keep the electron from the nucleus, the maximum of L is N minus 1. That's where that rule comes from, that L's maximum is N minus... Oh, dear. How did I do that? So what's the practical upshot of all this? Well, let's look at the L values first. Because, one more time, think of that phone cord demonstration. When you had the lowest possible level, there were zero nodes. When you had one, the next highest level, you had one node. The next highest level, two nodes. So imagine you're traveling around in a sphere. If you're traveling around in a sphere and you have no nodes, then that means you're going to have an object that looks just like a sphere. But let's say that instead, as you go around the sphere, you've got one node. Well, due to symmetry, that node is actually going to cut through the sphere. And if we did that, what do we generate? Well, end up generating a kind of dumbbell shape. I'm going to shade this in, but save talking about that just for a moment. Why am I doing it two different colors? Go up one more energy level. Throw one more packet of energy around that nucleus, and you're going to have a second node. Which one of the ways of doing it is to have those nodes perpendicular to each other, which will generate this kind of shape. Well, we recognize these as S, P, and D orbitals. So this has all been a really complicated story to explain. Why do these orbitals have these specific shapes? It's related to the number of nodes, which is related to the specific energy packets you can throw into an atom. Now, this connection between N and L, again, L only has a certain maximum value. This is why, for example, there's no such thing as a 1P orbital. Because in the one energy level, there's just not enough energy to generate that node to make a P orbital. You've got to have at least two energy packets. So that's why the P orbital only shows up at the second level. That's why a D orbital only shows up starting with the third level. You have to have enough of those energy packets. Now let me show you a little bit what the alternate possibility is. And I know this you might not have covered before. This might be a little confusing. And in fact, on Tuesday next week when we're in lab again, I'm going to try to remember to bring a little program to show you some of these orbitals. But it's not going to be something we use in here. But we are going to be dealing with molecular orbitals later on. So a little groundwork if we do now will save us a lot of heartache later on. What I'm getting at is the following. That we know there's such things as 1s orbital, 2s orbital, 3s orbital, 4s orbital. All of those orbitals would be ones in which you're not throwing those packets of energy around the nucleus. But then where's the energy going? Well, in that radial function, moving the electron further away from the nucleus. But that means in the radial function, you're going to start having nodes. So if you look at a 1s orbital, and you look at the wave function, it's just going to be a declining function. But if you look at the function for a 2s orbital, it actually crosses the axis just once, because there's that one more node. If you look at a 3s orbital, it will cross the axis twice. So what? Oh, yes.
Is the value of y axis?
The y axis? That's a complicated answer, because there is no physical meaning to that psi value. The Born interpretation of quantum mechanics says that the square of that is the probability of finding an electron somewhere in space. That is one interpretation. The main one, the easiest one, you could say. But therefore, there is no easily expressible physical meaning for psi. Now, what's the big deal about there being these nodes? Well, this is just the value of the function as you go in one direction around a radius, or along a radius. Whip that around in a sphere now. And what's that going to give us? Well, a 1s orbital looks just like what you expect it to. A 2s orbital is not a sphere. It is a sphere within a sphere. And between those spheres is a node. And this is what's always confusing in 1A when we do this more in depth. Spherical nodes are lines. Linear nodes are spheres. What? Means this. If you go from the radius and you have a node of one point of a radius, but then pull that around in a circle, you're going to make a circle. So if you have a node that just shows up at a point, well, it turns into a sphere once you wrap it all the way around. So a 2s orbital is really a sphere inside a sphere. A 3s orbital is therefore a sphere inside a sphere inside a sphere. This really is just sort of for informational purposes, because on a practical level, all we're going to use is the simplified S and P orbital pictures. See, a 2P orbital looks like the P orbital that I've shown here. A 3P orbital looks like a dumbbell inside a dumbbell. But we just don't worry about that. So, we're a bit low on time. This is an impossible topic to squeeze into one lecture. So, let me move on to address some of these other topics briefly, before we do run out of time. The first topic that we got to review is electron configuration. And related to electron configuration is the octet rule. What is the octet rule? The outer shell of an element. So atoms somehow behave unusually stably. If you think of something like fluorine, fluorine atomic, it violently reacts to get electrons. Once it gets that electron and becomes F-, it kind of just sits around. The noble gases, because they have these octet configurations, normally don't react. Turns out we can force them to react, but they don't like to react. So there's something magic about having the number 8. Before I define the octet rule, I've got to define these terms. Shell and subshell. Because there's a reason why 8 is the magic number. So does anybody remember what a shell is? Yeah. Now, we seem to have a lot of interaction from this side of the classroom. What about this side of the classroom? Because they're not the only ones taking the exam, you know. Oh, come on. None of you remember Shell, or you're just too afraid to say it? Because I won't laugh at a wrong answer, but I will get annoyed if no one answers. Energy level. That's right. A shell is a particular value of N, the principal energy value. So shell is an energy level, which is a specific value of N. What is a subshell, then? It's a specific value of L. It's all of the same kind of orbital within a shell. So if I say, for example, 2p, there's really three different 2p orbitals. If you're talking about all of those combined, that is the 2p subshell. So the subshell is the specific value of L inside a shell. So the octet rule states that atoms are unusually stable when the S and P subshells are filled. For the outermost shell, which is where we get our valence electrons. Now, why is it that the octet rule works, or what's going on? Well, if you're treating electrons like waves, now this will be a hard one to explain. I have to use a musical metaphor. If you think about music and you have multiple instruments playing, if they play in just the right way, then to us it sounds pleasing. These notes reinforce themselves. They're waves. Well, electrons being waves, they can end up interacting with themselves to cause some kind of reinforcement. And when you fill subshells, you get that synergy occurring. You get an unusually lower energy configuration by having exactly that number of waves. Now, valence electrons. What are valence electrons? The electrons of the outermost shell, which are the most energetic electrons. I'm going to go just 2 minutes over, and then the last little bit of this, I guess I'll do in our lab section, because I don't want to make you all potentially late to your other classes. Does anybody have a 10:30 class? Okay, so we'll wrap up for now in just a moment, and then I'll finish this in lab. What I wanted to wrap up with is showing you the electron configurations for fluorine, chlorine, and bromine. Which in lab I'll review how can you cheat. If you don't remember how to do electron configurations, how can you use the periodic table to come back to them? But for now, fluorine has a configuration of 1s2, 2s2, 2p5. Chlorine, 1s2, 2s2, 2p6, 3s2, 3p5. Bromine, 1s2, 2s2, 2p6, 3s2, 3p6, 4s2, 3d10, 4p5. So what are the valence electrons of fluorine? Well, they're all the electrons in the outermost shell, not the outermost subshell. So it's all the ones in the 2 level for fluorine. The valence electrons for chlorine, then, would be everything that's in the 3 level. The valence electrons for bromine, then, would be everything in the 4 level. So these elements are elements in the same, what's called, group. Act similarly because they have the same number of valence electrons. For lecture material, I wanted to finish a little bit with electron configurations and then electron filling, and then we just have a little brief note about isotopes. So I had mentioned towards the ends of lecture that there is a way to use the periodic table as a way to cheat and figure out electron configurations for the most part. Now, if you remember your Chem 1A, you know there's elements like copper and chromium that can have exceptions, but we're hardly going to be dealing with any of those types of elements in this class. We're almost always going to be confined to carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, hydrogen, phosphorus, sulfur, just a handful of elements. But if I were to write out periodic table in this kind of form, and ignoring those transuranic elements, those elements that include things like uranium, you see that I've divided this up into 3 blocks. Now, the 2 columns on the periodic table that would be on the left, what's the name that we assign to that block? The S block, that's right. And then for the 6 columns on the right-hand side of the periodic table, that's the P block. And in the middle where the transition metals are, that's the D block. Why do we call these the S, the P, and the D blocks? The last electron that you put in for that particular element is going to be the type of orbital that's listed on these blocks. So hydrogen, that's in the S block. The first electron that you put in goes into a 1s orbital. As we'll talk about just momentarily, you can squeeze 2 electrons into a single orbital. So for helium, the next electron that goes in also goes in a 1s orbital. There is only an S orbital at the 1 level, so the very next electron that would go in would have to go into a 2s orbital. So that would be for lithium. Then beryllium would also be in the S block, so that would be the next electron, a 2s. Boron is over here in the P block, and that matches with the fact that the next electron, the 5th electron that you would put in, is a P electron. So as you go along the periodic table, for the most part, that structure of the periodic table matches electron configuration. So when we're not dealing with elements like copper that have exception, you just keep on following along, and that's how you can come up with this 1s, 2s, 2p, 3s, 3p order. Just to clarify, though, it is not electron configuration that establishes where an element goes on the periodic table. What is the thing that establishes where it goes on the periodic table? They happen to have that, but because we do have these exceptions, that's why it's not just electron configuration that decides the order. It's atomic number, the number of protons, which for neutral elements, number of protons is the number of electrons. But it is atomic number that is used to determine position on the periodic table. So I just wanted to have mentioned that. Now, there are these electron filling rules. Which work not just for atomic orbitals, which is where you've probably used them before, but they work for molecular orbitals as well. And since we will be talking about molecular orbitals all 3 quarters, you need to know these rules. What is one of the filling rules? Any one of them. And do you remember the name of that rule? No, but that is one of them. The one you're describing is actually Hund's rule, which says that if you have multiple equal energy orbitals, or what are called degenerate orbitals, that one electron will fill each orbital first before you pair electrons up. The Pauli exclusion principle is the one that says an orbital can have a maximum of two electrons, technically if they have, only if they have opposite spins. And then what's the last filling rule? It's called the Aufbau principle, which means building up. The electrons will fill from the lowest energy up through the highest energy. So we're not going to use these rules at all today, but just wanted to have reviewed what they are. So the very last topic, then, is about isotopes. Anybody remember what an isotope is? Yes? Same number of protons, different number of neutrons. So same element, but different flavors, you could say, of that element. And the isotopes I'd like to just mention for today are the three forms of hydrogen, which this would be their partial atomic symbols, where I show their mass number and atomic number. But even more frequently, we use just simple one-letter abbreviations. Quite technically, the hydrogen that's just a proton is called protium. The hydrogen that is the second form that has a mass number 2, does anybody know the name of that one? Deuterium, right. And then the third form? Tritium. ...99% roughly of hydrogen is normal protium. But we will use deuterium when we get to nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy. We'll also encounter deuterium when we talk a little bit about kinetics. The only other note I'll make about isotopes is that there is an isotope of carbon, carbon 13, that we also use spectroscopically. So any questions about the filling rules, this little bit I said about the connection to the periodic table, or about isotopes?